stay tuned for a pre-recorded interview with Jessica Leving, who hosts a podcast for brothers and sisters of people with intellectual disabilities. But first, disability news for the week of October 26, 2020. Congress is pressing the Trump administration to track COVID-19 among people with disabilities living in group homes and institutions where over 6 months into the pandemic cases are still mostly going undocumented. Three U.S. senators are calling on the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to collect and report data on the number of coronavirus cases in a broader array of congregate settings, including those serving people with disabilities, by the end of October. CMS requires nursing homes to report COVID-19 cases to federal officials and notify residents and their families, but no mandate exists for other types of congregate settings, even though their residents also face a high risk of transmission. Advocates have been pressuring Medicaid officials for months to establish similar procedures for facilities serving people with disabilities, but CMS has remained silent on the request. The request comes as the country sees a recent surge in coronavirus cases amid an ongoing pandemic that has excessively affected those with developmental disabilities. Research shows that people who are living in group homes are significantly more likely to contract the virus and die from it as compared to others. The senators stated in their letter that a review of state-level requirements across the country found only 9 states that are reporting on COVID-19 cases at institutions for people with disabilities, 7 report on group homes, and just 1 is reporting on day facilities for those with disabilities. The lawmaker said that even where CMS does not have the authority to impose requirements on the facilities themselves, the agency should use its regulatory power to set, quote, standardized, comprehensive COVID-19 reporting requirements on states to collect data across different types of congregate care settings in which providers participate in Medicaid, end quote. The senators are asking CMS to act by October 30th, but so far, the senators have received no reply. CMS, who said they would reply directly to the senators, noted that in many states, COVID-19 transmission in group homes is considered a critical incident, and in those cases, such data would be included as part of regular quality assurance reporting to the federal government. However, they also acknowledge that it is not undertaking broad efforts to track COVID-19 across congregate settings serving people with developmental disabilities. Lexington, Kentucky's Employment Solutions operates several-day training programs. Prior to the coronavirus outbreak in March, it had 150 participants. Now it has only 40 to 50 participants. Most day training programs, which can provide exercise and arts classes, other activities, and jobs to people with disabilities, are struggling across the state and across the country. Those programs closed from March until late June. When day training programs reopened this summer, the number of participants plummeted. Similar programs across the country have had less than a third of their clients return. A number have closed with no sign that they will reopen. Many others are on the brink of closure. Many people with intellectual and developmental disabilities have pre-existing health conditions that make returning to congregate settings impossible. Some providers have purchased additional cleaning supplies and brought back more staff to make it safe for participants to return. Costs have increased, but revenues have plummeted because the number of clients using the programs have been dramatically reduced. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which oversees Medicare and Medicaid at the federal level, has issued guidance encouraging states to issue retainer payments during the pandemic to preserve the community-based day training programs. Other organizations and providers have also promoted increasing the Medicaid reimbursement, the amount providers are paid to keep those facilities running. Many providers received payroll protection loans through the coronavirus relief funding during the pandemic's early months, but that assistance has expired. Advocates say that congregate day programs are less effective than true community-based work and activities, and that many are choosing alternatives to that model. In California, it's reported that parents of medically fragile children are still not receiving their regular supplies of equipment due to shortages caused by the pandemic, forcing them to wash and reuse items that would normally be thrown away to comply with safety recommendations. Based on national estimates, California is home to about 35,000 children with medical complexities, children with chronic conditions that require significant medical attention and specialized equipment such as ventilators, children with cystic fibrosis, cerebral palsy, chronic heart conditions, or other congenital disorders. In the past, they've received monthly supplies, often paid through the state's health insurance program. SuperCare Health, one of California's largest respiratory equipment suppliers, says it is still rationing some ventilator supplies because it can't get enough from factories and wholesale distributors. The situation has improved since early in the pandemic, when hospitals and governments were rushing to buy up respiratory and personal protective equipment. But some items are still on back order, according to the company's chief executive officer, John Kasser. Existing patients are getting supplies, but may have to use them longer, he said. The company has also had to turn away some new clients because of shortages in equipment used for oxygen therapy. Kasser estimated the shortages would continue for another 6 months. Parent Jenny McClelland, however, said she worries the reduction in equipment is becoming calcified and that it's endangering the lives of children. She said, quote, "We're not going to hear about a direct death that is directly attributable to this, but a population of kids who get pneumonia and die frequently will get pneumonia more often and die more frequently, but no one is tracking that." End quote. And finally, a new study suggests that the number of hours of early intervention therapy for young children with autism may not be all that consequential. Researchers say they found similar outcomes in toddlers with autism, whether they participated in 15 or 25 hours each week of one-on-one intervention. The findings come from a study that evaluated two very different styles of autism intervention: early intensive behavioral intervention, which is rooted in applied behavior analysis, and Early Start Denver model, which uses an interactive approach and is implemented through everyday activities. Both methods are known to bring about significant gains in language, cognitive, and adaptive skills. Ultimately, the study found no meaningful difference in the level of progress in receptive language, expressive communication, nonverbal ability, or autism symptoms across the four different treatment groups. That was the case even when comparing children with varying levels of severity at the outset, the researcher said. Researchers said the findings need to be replicated and should be tested in older children to determine if they respond differently. And that's the news for this week. Plastic tubes and pots and pans, bits and pieces, and the magic from my hand are making weird sightings. All the things I've never seen before, behind open doors, down an imagination, weird sights. Not what teachers said to do, making dreams come true, living tissue. And you are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, and I'm joined today by a fairly recent guest on the program, Jessica Leving, who was on several weeks ago for about a children's book that she wrote. Well, Jessica's been busy again, and so she's back on the program to talk about her new podcast called Special Siblings. Welcome to the program, Jessica.
Hi, thanks so much for having me back again.
You are a busy woman, I must say.
Yes, it has been busy lately.
Yeah, I'm sure it has been. So why don't you reintroduce yourself to the listeners, for those who may not have heard about your book, and we'll maybe mention the book along the way as well.
Sure, yeah. So my name is Jessica Leving, and growing up, my brother Billy was diagnosed with autism when I was about 6 years old, and I wrote a children's book about my experience growing up, what it was like to be the sibling of someone with a disability. I wrote it when I was in high school, but it was just published officially this past year. And since the launch of the book, we have also launched a podcast, which was not planned. It actually came about after the book because I started going around and doing some readings and like story times and, you know, different author events to share the book with families. And a lot of parents and teachers were asking me all these questions about other resources for siblings. And, you know, I had just written the book. I didn't really know anything else. So I didn't have anywhere to point them. And I started thinking, well, you know, my undergrad degree is in journalism, and I like interviewing people. So really kind of just thought I would lean on those interview and journalism skills to interview other people who do have the answers and bring them on the show. And what's really nice about a podcast is it's just there, and now it's uploaded on, you know, iTunes, and people can download it whenever and have that access wherever they are, whenever they're tuning in to interviews with psychologists and researchers. We've got a couple of sibling stories, like coming from, we just last night had someone on who is 22, or I think 23, and she's the primary caregiver for her sister who has Down syndrome. A couple weeks ago, we had a mom on with her five-year-old. So really just quite the range of different people talking about sibling issues. And yeah, the reception has been good so far. It's been really exciting, and I'm hoping that it'll really help point people in the right direction if they're looking for more information.
And people are always looking for more information. That is absolutely the case. So this is relatively new. How many episodes do you have up posted on iTunes and the other platforms right now?
We have 5 episodes. We just published our 5th episode yesterday.
So very, very new. And so far, what are the most interesting things that have come from those interviews and conversations that you've had?
Well, I think I recorded a bunch of the interviews in advance, and the one that I decided to publish first as the first episode was an interview we did with a psychologist named Dr. Avidan Malevsky, and he is a specialist in researching sibling issues across the board, not just siblings of people with disabilities, but all different ways that our sibling relationships can affect the way that we live the rest of our lives. And he shared with me that there have been some studies actually showing a statistical relationship. And I always, you know, try to be careful because I don't want to say that they haven't, you know, proven what causes what. But having a sibling with a disability is linked to higher rates of anxiety, depression, and eating disorders in adulthood. And I thought that was really interesting because, you know, I'm in a Facebook group for adult siblings. I know a lot of adult siblings, and I've certainly heard a lot of people talk about having these issues. But I didn't realize that there is actually scientific evidence showing that these rates are higher among siblings, which to me really should be pushing more people to be looking at what we can be doing to support siblings, because there's not a lot out there. And obviously there's a strong need, and I feel like it's a mental health issue that we should be looking at, like early intervention. How can we support young kids? How can we support them as they get older and are looking at taking on caregiving roles? You know, there's so much there, and there are a few organizations that are out there doing amazing work, but there's not really public awareness in the way that I would like there to be.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that stems from the fact that many times siblings of people with disabilities often are, how do I want to describe this, on the spectrum of being good kids. You know, they are generally the ones that are the overachievers and the ones who don't want to cause their parents to be any more stressed out than they already are based on the lives that they have supporting their kid with a disability. So, you know, would you think that this is the constant, that people who are siblings are always feeling anxious or stressed, or does it happen during certain periods? What was this psychiatrist's opinion on that, or did you talk about that?
Yeah, a little bit. So it doesn't, I don't know if there has been specific research to indicate like which, like, you know, at what age or during what specific types of experiences cause more anxiety. But what we did talk about was that it seems likely that, you know, you're right. I think there are a lot of anecdotes, you know, a lot of anecdotal evidence of many, many kids who are siblings feel like they have to be the good kid, that they can't bring home any problems, that their parents have enough to deal with. And so one of the things that this psychologist was talking about was that there are a lot of kids who learn to just shove their feelings down. And it's not something they do on purpose. It's just you start, and I can relate to this personally. It was so fascinating to talk to him. I'm like, oh, yeah, I do that.
Yeah, that's me.
Right. You know, you start thinking, like, I'm mad about something, or that wasn't fair. And you just, like, don't even allow yourself to feel it. You're like, nope, that's not how I feel. You know, and you just push it away. Or maybe something happens at school. You know, maybe you're worried about a big test, and you want to tell your parents about it, but then you see that they're very busy and stressed out dealing with your sibling, and so you're like, you know what, I'll deal with it myself. I'll figure out another way. And ideally, kids, you know, have other people in their lives they can be going to for support, whether that's teachers, or, you know, I think in the best case scenario, if parents can be more aware of these issues, there's, like, pretty easy opportunities for parents to just say, like, hey, I just want to check in with you. You know, I know I was really busy with your brother or sister earlier, but like, what's going on with you? You know, just, like, take that extra concerted effort to let them know, like, if you've got something going on, I'm available. I didn't get my energy completely used up by your sibling, even though they might, you know, and that's a whole other thing that it can be difficult for parents as well, of course. But, yeah, you just really learn to push your feelings down, and you can go a lot of years with that being really adaptive and working for you, but it is going to come out eventually in the form of anxiety or depression or, you know, some other way of getting those feelings out in a more harmful way.
Yeah. So there are, I've talked to a few siblings myself over the years, my own children who have a sister with Down syndrome, but also with parents or adults who have adult brothers and sisters who all of a sudden, you know, everything was just going along great with, you know, elderly mom and dad taking care of the adult. And then all of a sudden something happens to mom or dad, and this, you know, responsibility for their sibling has landed right square in their lap. Mm-hmm. And I can imagine that that would cause some anxiety. So for the folks who are listening to this program today, I think it might be helpful to speak maybe specifically to the moms and dads out there. And how can they better support their typically developing children so that mm-hmm. they can, you know, eliminate the stress and worry in their lives?
Yeah, so basically what I've kind of, how I've sort of divided it into categories in my head is I think if you start with, like, the earliest intervention, like the youngest age kids, I think a lot of it is about that emotional support and just making space for their emotions, validating their emotions, and really open communication. And then I think another category is providing resources for them to connect with other siblings. So, like, you know, sib shops are a great option. You know, part of writing the book is so that I wanted kids to have representation in the media, and there are, you know, a couple of other books, not a ton, but like connecting with other publications or media that help them feel like, oh, I'm not alone. Mm-hmm. And then as kids get older, I think, like, exactly what you're talking about, the transition and future planning is critical. And that kind of goes back to having an open line of communication from the beginning. I actually just completed an interview a few weeks ago that hasn't posted to the podcast yet with a researcher who specializes in looking at transition planning and how it affects families and kind of responses of siblings at different ages. And it was really interesting. She was talking about how younger siblings, like not little kids, but, you know, siblings in their teens and 20s, when they were surveyed about what they thought would happen in the future, they were all like, yep, I'm probably going to take care of my sibling, and that's fine. They were committed to doing that and didn't seem to be too stressed about it. But then when they interviewed older siblings that were in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and up, that's where they were hugely stressed and were sharing, like, oh, my God, I don't know what to do. I'm so stressed out. I don't know if I can do this. And they kind of, and you know, I'm not a psychologist, so I encourage everyone to tune into the episode. But basically my understanding was that it's because when you're younger, you kind of don't really understand the reality of it yet in terms of caregiving. And you kind of just think it's this far off thing that you'll deal with when it gets there. But once you're older, especially if something has happened where maybe a parent has become really ill really quickly, you know, if they haven't had open communication about what is happening, that's so overwhelming. Like, to just get dumped with, oh my God, I don't understand these documents. I don't know the financial plan. Where's money going to come from? Who's going to pay for my siblings' health care? And your parents might have even done a great job with future planning, but if they haven't shared that with the sibling and let them know, like, here's what I have, here are the resources, here's the plan, here's where to access these different documents that you need, here's the password to this account, you know, whatever, the details, they're starting from scratch. And especially, like, if a parent is suddenly ill or dies, you know, something, you're dealing with that trauma at the same time as, oh my God, I have to pick up all the pieces to care for my sibling. And, you know, parents think that they're protecting their kids by not burdening them with some of these issues, but it would actually, it sounds like the research is indicating that if you could piece it out earlier and just offer people a seat at the table, let siblings know, here's the plan, you know, it's not your responsibility yet, I've got it under control, but when the day comes, I want you to know what to do, that will help siblings really to feel prepared.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can totally relate to that perspective, as in that, you know, mom and dad and our family take care of all that stuff, and I need to do a better job of making sure that my other kids are well aware of what needs to, you know, what kinds of things we do and what the ideas are for the future and all that, you know, the specifics. I know a lot of people I've spoken to who have adult siblings with disabilities say, I didn't know thing one about the disability support system in the state. Didn't know anything about Medicaid, Medicare, home-based supports, group homes, none of that. I had no idea about anything. And so it was like having a almost like an awakening that was hinged on the trauma of losing their parent.
Right, exactly. And I mean, it's difficult, and I can relate from the sibling side. I mean, I feel very confident that my mom has really solid plans for my brother's future care, and we have had conversations about it, so I have some idea of what's happening. But, you know, even thinking about, like, am I practicing what I'm preaching here, like, it's difficult. Like, I don't know every single detail about it, and it does already feel a little overwhelming to think, like, oh my gosh, what are the intricacies of all of this stuff? And I think it's just, it kind of goes back to having that open communication from the beginning to just feel comfortable, like, going through it piece by piece so that you know that you can access the resources when you need them. And, you know, I think part of what I feel grateful for is that even if I don't understand every piece of it, I know that my mom has good records. I know that it's clear, you know, and that, it wouldn't be picking up 1,000 different pieces. It would be just deepening my knowledge of things that right now I have, like, a vaguer knowledge of, if that makes sense, you know? So it wouldn't be, like, everything from scratch. It would just be, like, okay, I've known that there, you know, that there are plans for housing. I know that there's a fund, you know, for his care. But learning, you know, actually how to administer them or how to, you know, negotiate with different service providers, that stuff can come later. But if we hadn't talked about it at all, that would just be crazy. So, you know, I think there can be a balance. Like, siblings don't have to necessarily be right there next to their parents doing everything at the same time. But just figuring out for families what makes sense in terms of, like, knowing where to go when you do need to find out that information.
Other than your podcast, which I think would be an excellent resource for siblings that are out there and have concerns about these issues, are you also involved with the Illinois Brothers and Sisters organization as well?
Yes, I am. So I actually just went to my first meetup with them a couple of weeks ago, which was awesome. It was very cool. And I think actually that would be another great way for siblings to kind of alleviate some stress is to connect with some of the groups in their area for adults, because, you know, it was a very big age range of different people and really cool to hear different perspectives and, you know, be able to connect with people my own age and similar life stages, but then also know that, like, oh, there are a bunch of people here who are a little bit older than me or have their, like, a family of their own or are planning for retirement, you know, so that I, like, kind of can see what the progression might look like as I'm getting older.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm also involved in, next month, either April or May, I am going to get trained as a facilitator for SIP shops. And I'm hoping that another thing I can start doing is to lead some SIP shops. And I've already actually been able to lead a couple of workshops, some of them which were part of existing SIP shops and some of which were separate, like, one-off events.
Those who don't know, what is a SIP shop?
Oh, yeah. So SIP shops are peer support groups. I don't know if they actually technically call them support groups, but they're groups for siblings. I want to say ages, like, 5 to 12, something like that, where kids can go meet other siblings. Actually, I guess it goes above 12 because the one I was at had teenagers. So I think the age depends on what area you're in, but they're recreational groups where you go and it's informal. It's not like sitting in a circle talking about, like, oh, when my sip does this, I feel this. It's playing games. The ones that I've visited as a guest, I've read the book and led some art workshops where kids can draw pictures of their sibling, and then we talk about, you know, how their experiences might match or not match the experiences I talk about in the book. And so I think different sip shops have different guests that come in and different activities. They meet on different schedules. Some of them are monthly, and they're hosted by different community organizations. So, like, some of them are within school districts and some of them are at community centers. I don't know the website off the top of my head, but if anybody is interested, you can Google SIP shops, and their website has a list of all of the different SIP shops that they have in different areas.
Well, I have a feeling that at some point in the relatively near future, you're going to have to be on the show again to talk about your work with SIB shops, because I know they've been big in the Chicago area, not so much in central and southern Illinois. So we need to find people who can do them, you know, around here, because there is a great need.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, my next project that I'm working on is trying to incorporate as a nonprofit, so kind of tying together some of the different work that I've been doing, and then hopefully then being eligible for some funding so that we can expand, and part of my hope for that is to be able to bring SIP shops to other places where they aren't existing yet, and share some additional resources with people throughout.
Sounds great.
You know, I'm in the Chicago area, but would love to get out there and travel around to different places that need it.
Well, if you're interested, folks who are listening, tune in to the podcast Special Siblings, available on iTunes and Soundscape or Apple?
Yeah, it's on iTunes, Spotify, and SoundCloud and
there.
Stitcher.
And hey, Jessica, tell your mom I said hi. She's awesome.
I will. Thank you.
Jessica
so
Loving, host of the podcast Special Siblings. Thanks for joining me. This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and have a great rest of your week.
No, I'll stay. Down, gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down.
You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Stay tuned now for Food Sleuth Radio.
Hi, welcome to Food Sleuth Radio, where we help you think beyond your plate. I'm Melinda Hemmelgarn, a registered dietitian and investigator.